We're doing our class on the Jewish home, and the time has come for our famous or infamous class that discusses my deep, dark history as a magician. So when I was a kid, I was very into magic. I was a member of all kinds of magicians' clubs and stuff. I didn't yet know the response of that, the halachos that forbid practicing magic. For what I knew then, I was a very active magician. You wouldn't catch me without 15 tricks on me at a minute. Anywhere I went. And one of the things I learned was also about the art of swindling, otherwise known as fortune telling, which I'll explain in a minute. Yes?
Surely there's no prohibition against card tricks or white magic.
It's a broad subject.
Which is basically just tricking nature into doing something.
It's too broad to cover now.
Magic doesn't really exist in and of itself. Magic is just using nature in a way that you don't quite understand.
Eitan, you're right in theory, but what can you do? I used to begin my magic shows showing people a trick and then explaining how it works, okay? So I take a coin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I'd explain to the audience that if you take the coin and rub it really well into the table, it comes through. And then I'd explain them that it's all sleight of hand, right? That they thought I took the coin, but really the coin was here, right? That's every trick I'm going to do is going to be just like that. And by the end of the show, I'd have people coming up to me, adults and kids, asking me to cure their relatives. So you can tell them this at the beginning of the show, but when the halacha says that if you're going to do sleight of hand, and even though I explained it at the beginning, but they were still convinced I had powers, what can you do when you pull a handkerchief out of thin air? They're convinced. So it's not so simple what you're saying. Meaning, at any rate, so coming back to our story, so...
With the coin,
when you think I'm taking it here, I'm really leaving it here. It's just sleight of hand. At any rate, coming back to our story as a fortune teller. So, a few times I developed my repertoire by going to old magicians who were retiring and buying out all their stuff. So, one magician who was retiring had a whole bookcase on fortune telling, on reading minds. And really, I'll demonstrate one of the things I learned from his books, and then I'll explain to you the concept afterwards, and then we'll see how it plays into marriage and human relationships in general. You were here last year, so don't give it away, okay? I see the look in your eyes. In order for this to really work, I need you guys to look me in the eye. We're going to go one by one. And I hope you don't mind my prying into your souls. But I'm going to take a minute now to, after looking at each of you, to look for a common theme, you know, something which will speak to each of you based on what I see in the depths of your hearts. And that being said, you'll forgive me, I want to discuss with you something, again, nothing personal. I mean, it's very personal, but don't hold it against me.
I can do that too.
So, if I were to tell you something that is going on within each of you, so I have to say that without embarrassing anyone, but each of you has somewhere deep down inside of you some place that you don't really like going. A part of you which is insecure, is lonely. It's something in your past that you're not even sure how to quantify, how to define, but it's a part, it's with you even today. It's something that, dark, lonely, fearful, if everyone knew, then what would they think? that part of you which you prefer not to address. And unfortunately, I just put it on the table in front of you. Guess what? I do this every year. It's true for everyone. So if you talk to people, now, if I were a fortune teller and I was looking to make some money off of you, then I would be sitting here in a dark room and I'd have a crystal ball in front of me and I'd make you confident that I knew what was going on by you. Now, the more I'm going to talk about this, the more a person who's open to it is going to say, hey, he's on the mark, because these are universal themes. It has nothing to do with you. We can develop this. Every person has within him or her areas, and it's partially related to our past, it's partially related to our present, areas that we're uncomfortable with, areas that we like to ignore, areas that are lonely and that we fear. And that's something which can be viewed as a weakness, and if I'm a fortune teller who's looking to make money off of you, then I can exploit that weakness. But if I'm a human being, so I should be aware of that and take that knowledge with me into marriage. Why is that so relevant to marriage? Because deep down inside, one of the great drives that lead us to marriage is the desire to fill that gaping hole. The desire to be loved. The desire to love and be loved, the desire to overcome that loneliness, the desire to be accepted in spite of the weaknesses that I know I have, in spite of the dark parts of me that I know are a part of me. The desire to have a partner who's with me for all of life. And then there are two issues that we face when we actually walk into marriage. The first issue is there's that fear, will the other side accept me as is? If they really knew who I was, would they be accepting of me? And then people are very scared to put that on the table. And when people actually venture to put that on the table, the other side doesn't even understand how important the conversation is. And they're very quick to respond, and usually respond incorrectly. And bring us back to a point where we say, boy, am I stupid. I'm never going to put this one on the table again. And then there's a certain frustration and a certain resignation to the idea that this relationship is going to have to be limited. I'm not going to put all of myself on the table or into this relationship, which is very sad. And then that's, you understand the cycle there. If I can't put it out, then this relationship isn't what I wanted it to be. If it's not exactly what I wanted it to be, then I'm not going to give as much as I would have given. And then it's a cycle. It's a vicious cycle. So that's problem number one. And the way to overcome that is by introducing it. By saying to the spouse, look, I really want to share with you, I really want to discuss with you things that are very close to me, and they're not easy for me to put on the table. And I'm very scared that when I put them on the table, you're not going to be accepting of me. You're going to laugh at me. And that's the worst thing. So if you can be serious and accept me for who I am, I want to share them with you. And sometimes the best place to do that is in the bedroom when the lights are off, when you don't have to worry that they're going to see your face. And you can have the conversation that way. And again, it's very, very important to introduce it. Because sometimes we're going to take the most sensitive part of ourselves and put it on the other on the table, and the other side is going to burst out laughing. And then you're devastated. And you tell yourself, I'm never doing that one again. Yeah.
Isn't that late, though? I mean, if somebody is deciding on a spouse, and if one doesn't, first of all, one has to accept it oneself, and you made mistakes or whatever, and then back to love yourself, you think you're no good. Probably the other person too, but let's say you've done that. Wouldn't you want to have this out in the open before you're in the dark in the bedroom? I mean, that's already assuming it's after you're married, and then if the person doesn't accept it, it's a big problem. I'm just asking, isn't that something that should come?
I think we're talking about things which won't even come up in the beginning of marriage. I think there are things, meaning, obviously, who I am to a large degree is going to come up before marriage. But then there's a part of us which we're not so quick to put on the table, which we're not so quick to talk about with ourselves, which we, some of the things, maybe it's better if we leave out there, not to discuss it.
But if you do it in a way that's, you've already got out some, you really love the person, you know, whatever. Give an example, 15 years ago, I was an idiot and I blew a $10,000 credit line in Las Vegas. So did something really you're ashamed of. And you did.
I'm talking about some things that are much more deep.
Okay.
I mean, well, I think that every person has those areas, and I think that I don't think you can expect them to come up until the relationship solidifies down the road.
Possibly because it's there's a real issue of what one says, if what one has an obligation to say beforehand, because otherwise, I would feel loved if you think, well, if the person really knew me, she wouldn't love me. Then
I think that there's the person who we are, which is a large part of who we are, that everyone knows, that our spouse is going to know, and that that we bring to the date and that we share on the date. And there's a fantastic, I'd say 95% of who we are. And then there's a certain 5%, which is very private, which I don't think every person has to put it on the table. I don't think every person wants to put it on the table, and that's to each his own. Correct. You don't lose autonomy because you got married.
There was something so tragic if you never knew earlier.
I think that for most people, there's a great desire to share that and be accepted with that. And I don't think you can reach that level of a relationship during the dating. And I think that most people live their lives and they never reach that. And I don't think it's the end of the world if a couple never reaches that, or if a person says, I don't want to share that. And I think that's their right. I don't think that you can gauge and say there's a right or a wrong here, but I think there are many people who would want to.
Yeah, and it's very sad if they don't.
Right. I don't see that a person can get there even in the beginning of marriage. I don't think so.
It's not so tragic probably if they don't, even though it is on some level, is because the way you're saying it, some people aren't ready to do that. And the spouse is ready to
hear. Right. Right. And I don't think it's the end of the world.
Okay.
But my point was more the other way. Very often, it's not as big a point as you think. Very often, it's the point that a person is not whole with themselves, feels that they missed out on certain very pivotal opportunities in life, feels that they might have missed out on key things in their lives, regrets that their last conversation with their parent was this, or can never forgive themselves because they had an opportunity to do A or B or C, and they know they messed it up. It can be really big things or small things. There was a guy once who had a girlfriend before he did tshuva, and she was pregnant, and then she had an abortion. And he couldn't live with himself because he knew that there was a human life that he should have ensured came to the world, and he didn't. So that was something which really was sad on him. Now, there are different levels. It's very hard to say what has to be discussed pre-marriage, what not, how much this is a part of a person's life, how much not. And anyways, that's not our class. A dating class is a totally different question. What has to be discussed beforehand? I don't want to go there because that deserves a whole separate discussion. We already said that our class starts the day after the wedding, not all the dating beforehand. So that's a separate question that needs to be discussed. But there are issues which a person has which are not a part of his daily life. They're not things that he thinks about on a day-to-day basis. They're not a part of who he is per se every day, but they are a part of who he is deep down inside. And a person wants to share them, and a person wants to have a relationship where they can share them. And the key to being able to share them is to set up the scene so that the other side appreciates what they're supposed to do when they hear. So that's number one. But number two is, can we be an accepting spouse? Meaning, we know what we'd like to receive. Do we know how to give? And that's where it becomes much more complicated. Now, let's take a few examples. Your spouse always oversleeps, shows up late to work, shows up late to meetings. What's the natural reaction? Hey, you know, you better get your act together. You want me to get you another alarm clock? We come with a million brilliant suggestions. Did we do anything? Yeah, we heard our spouse. Did we accomplish anything? Usually not. Usually a person knows their faults very, very well. Usually a person lives in a certain denial of their own faults. And there's this duality that's at play, meaning when a person will talk about their faults, if they're already forced to talk about them, they're usually going to take one of two extremes. Either they'll go to an extreme, say, yeah, I'm a terrible person, I never show up on time, I waste everyone's time. They go to that extreme. I don't know if you guys ever heard that type of conversation. You try to talk to someone about something they do wrong, and they're like, they go off the handle. Yeah, I'm the most horrible person in the world. Really, no one should live with me. The world would be a better place if I were dead. I don't know if you guys ever heard this. That's one angle that people take. And then there's the opposite extreme, where a person says, oh, I'm not so bad. You know, I have my days when I'm on time. I have my days when I'm late. I'm like everyone else. You know, okay, so maybe, you know, everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. Maybe I'm a little bit less good than everyone else. Fine, big deal. So I have other strengths that make up for it. And neither one is real, but that doesn't matter. You're dealing with a real person who approaches it this way, or at least externally approaches it this way. Internally, what's really going on? Usually a person knows. Usually a person might have a certain element of denial, but on many levels a person knows where they're wrong. And when we bring it up, so what we're saying is, we're saying a bunch of things. We're saying, I don't accept you as is. I expect you to change. So we've already hurt that first point, which we discussed, that we all have that internal need to be accepted as is. The first point that happens when I come and rebuke my spouse is I've said, I don't accept you as is. That's a very sad and powerful sentence. Now, you'll say, I didn't say that. But you did. It's intrinsic to what you said. But I just thought it's good advice. So, you've still said that. So that's point number one. Point number two. You've hurt your spouse. And in essence, you've made a sentence. You've made a statement. It is more important for me that you change than that you feel good about yourself. Meaning, this issue is more important to me than the question of hurting your feelings or not. And you could say, I didn't say that either. But again, it's implicit to what you've said. If you've said it, then you've said, I don't accept you as is. And it's more important for me that you change this than that you have a nice night tonight or have a nice day today. Let's take an example. Your spouse leaves to work and they're late again. And again, they're going to have a day where they're going to have to make up and the coworkers are going to be upset at them and you're going to have to take the kids because they're running late. And you throw out a line instead of saying, have a great day. You say, you know, maybe you should think about getting to bed at a normal time, not sitting on the internet so late tonight because look at what the price is going to be. And with that, you both your ways part. You're right. Remember, it's never a question of whether you're right or wrong. That's not the question. We like to think that's the question, but, you know, reverse the roles in a minute. The spouse leaves to work. They've left with that sentence. That's the stamp on the day. You know, you're going to try to give a phone call, send an SMS, but, you know, at the end of the day, those were the parting words. Was it worth it? What did we gain? What did we lose? And these things happen so easily. It's the easiest thing to do. That's the most natural thing to do. So the mode we have to enter is one where we realize that no rebuke. Zero. Zero? Yeah, zero. Wait, were you serious? Did he say zero? Yeah, he said zero. He did. I heard him. Zero. And when I say this, people think I'm exaggerating. We have to realize that any time you say any element of criticism, you're hurting your spouse's feeling, and it doesn't matter how right you are. If we take one formula, if there's one point you guys should remember when you leave this class, there's simple formula. Compliments build relationships. Rebuke destroys relationships. And it has nothing to do with how right you are. That's irrelevant. Who cares? And this goes on a range of topics, meaning your wife is going to see you impatient as you're studying with the kid, and she's going to come and say, you know, don't you think you should be a little bit more patient when you're learning with him? What's your answer going to be? You're going to get all defensive and say, don't you think it's a good thing that I take the time to learn with him? So she's going to feel like telling you, no, maybe not. Maybe you're doing more harm than good. But she's going to be decent and not say that. But did she accomplish anything? Maybe, maybe not. Our first formula that we have to know is that compliments build connection, criticism destroys connection. And if you work with that framework, then you can accomplish at least as much and usually much more. Just find the way to compliment. So what will the layman say? Okay, fine. So I'm going to come to my spouse and say, that was so nice that you learned with him. If only you would rebuke him less or yell at him less. Or... No, no, no. It's not what we're talking about. Find ways to compliment the positive, and through that, find ways to discuss, to find resolution, to find other ways. Sometimes it's just complimenting. There was a guy who was dying for his wife to clean the house. She never had time. So when she did, he'd compliment it. So then she cleaned the house more. We all take better to compliments. Then sometimes you could have a discussion. You know, that's oftentimes the best. You know, I noticed you were learning with him and he really didn't know his stuff. And I'm just wondering what should be our approach as parents. Maybe we should think together when we're sitting with a kid and he doesn't know his stuff. Maybe we should think about together. I wanted to think with you how we should deal with it. And then you might find that your spouse says to you, you know, I'm happy you brought that up because I really find I'm losing my patience when they don't know their stuff and when we're doing homework. And then, look, you've accomplished the same thing without saying a word. You've accomplished even more. Very often, if you just bring up the discussion, so then, again, you have to do it intelligently. No one likes feeling like they're a child, but yeah, you could bring up the discussion. Yeah, so that's, again, where do we begin and where do we get to? We begin with our own needs, and every person's needs to be accepted, even though we know our faults. Every person's need for friendship. Every person's need for a relationship they could rely on. That dark place within us that needs acceptance. We discussed how we can bring it on the table if we've given enough introductions where the other side knows what's expected of them in reacting. And then the other side also needs to be accepted. And that when we criticize, what we're saying is, A, I don't accept you. B, it was more important for me to criticize than for you to feel good about yourself. And then we said, if we're going to take one formula, then the formula is compliments build, criticism destroys. Uri?
What I was going to say is, you know, more effective what I was going to say. You said that you're telling her that criticism, right? And you're adding like, oh, and by the way, you are right, you know? But the very fact that you're right actually makes the criticism seem a little more than if you weren't right. Because, you know, if you're right, she's like, she knows it. And it's like even more aggravating, you know, to bring it up on this.
What's the definition of a friend? So someone once said, the definition of a friend is someone you could call at 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, and they won't get upset at you and say, hey, what'd you call me for? They're accepting. If you called, obviously there was a need, and they're there for you.
If they call without your need, are you allowed to be upset? Are you a friend?
What would you want your friend to do?
No, but like if he calls, like just to say how are you? I have experience.
Let me tell you an interesting story. I was once... I could tell you a few stories. I once called a principal who was my own teacher when I was a student. I had a serious chinuch issue. I wanted to consult with him. And I called him up at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. And he answered me calmly and everything. And when we finished the discussion, he said to me, you know, I'm just wondering, did you feel that this has to be discussed now? I looked at my watch. Now, what happened? I was dealing with the school and the other side of the United States. So I kept dealing with their hours. Meaning I had to talk to a principal there. I had a student who had graduated the school I was teaching in and moved on to that school. So I was working with their hours. And I forgot that I'm calling the guy back in New York. So I'm working LA time. I'm 4 hours earlier. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Over there, it's 10 o'clock at night. Okay. Or earlier. I don't remember what the difference was. But and then I'm calling him. 12:31, whatever. I'm calling him at a crazy hour his time. But, you know, when you're working the other person's hours, I didn't realize till the end of the conversation. I woke him. I called him in the middle of the night. But, you know, so that happens too. And he had no way of understanding it. I was so impressed. You know, he's answering me and he's talking and everything. And then at the end of the conversation, he just like, you know, what's going on here? So that's what happened there. I once had a guy who came knocking on the door at 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, I don't remember the time. So we sit down and we talk. And then he leaves. And I'm wondering, like, okay, what happened there? I didn't know what happened there. But turns out the guy was considering suicide. You know, he had that conversation and he walked away feeling good about himself and goodbye. Now imagine if you have the conversation and 20 minutes into the conversation, you're going like, hey, buddy, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm just wondering. You knocked on my door at 1 o'clock. I'm just wondering, like, what's the deal? You don't know. I mean, the job of a friend is that if they come, you answer. My problem is that too many people knock at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, at some point you say, hey, if I'm not going to sleep, I'm like, you know, how am I going to function? But whatever. I think that's our job. If you're going to be a good friend, so then if someone knocks at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. But again, the key wasn't the example. The key was, what's the idea behind the example? That I don't necessarily understand the person, but I'm going to be accepting of them as is. Meaning, just because you married someone doesn't mean you understand them. One of the places that this really comes to play is when it comes to familial relationships. Meaning, she might have an issue with her mom that she feels like her mom is second-guessing everything she does. And you can't figure it out. You think her mom is the nicest person in the world, and you don't know the backdrop to the scene. You don't know what's been going on for 22 years. Now you're married, and you think you know. So realize that you don't know. And suddenly she could be talking to her mother, and every time she talks to her mother, there's an explosion, and she's all fireworks. I can't stand how my mother tells me about this and that and the other thing. And you try telling her, look, your mother means well. It's not such a big deal. No, don't be telling her that. That's a... You can't really understand what's going on between them, and you have to accept her as is. It's not our job to rebuke or tell her what to do. People might say, is this a problem that part of our desire for a relationship stems from our own fear of being alone? From our own desire of acceptance? And I think the answer is no. It's a major component, human component, of every relationship. We want that relationship. Let's take an example, and it's something to think about when you're having a discussion with your spouse. Imagine you were given a major project, a multi-million dollar project, which, if you succeed, is going to set you up. It's gonna set you well for life. And you work really hard in this project for 3 months. The whole family doesn't have any Abba time with you. then you're focused and you figure it's for everyone's benefit. And at the end of the 3 months, you finish. And let's say your project was Mitt Romney's election campaign computer program. Okay, let's take that example. And the day of the election comes and it's a massive failure. And they're saying that Mitt Romney lost and there's a good chance that it's your fault. So of course you're fired and no one's going to want to hire you again. And you trudge home.
But did you get the money?
No. Oh. And you don't get all the money you were expecting. Quite the contrary. There are lawsuits pending. Okay? And forget the payment. There are lawsuits pending. And you walk through the doors of your house. What welcome do you want to get? Now, what's a classical welcome? Bob, at least we could have had those 3 months together. You know, we gave up those 3 months and it didn't work out anyways. Or silence. What do you want when you come home and the rest of the world thinks you're a failure? You want someone who isn't going to deny that you had a failing. It's true. It didn't succeed. But someone who can see the good in you, accept you as is and love you as is. And we have those times in life. You guys know I'm a Moel. You know who my first bris was? My own son. And I didn't have the right teacher then. I worked with one person. And I felt I didn't know what I was supposed to do. So I tried to get him to explain to me, and he didn't have patience. And then, you know, went back and forth. And then I figured I do understand. And then comes the bris. So we're standing there, and he sets everything up. And I do a cut. And he yells at me, "Not like that." So I'm thinking, I did what he told me. And he takes the foreskin and says, "You didn't cut enough," and cuts a second time. 2 cents is a high price for how I felt for the next 2 weeks. You know, it's in front of all my relatives, all my family. It's the first time. And, I felt like I couldn't get out of bed the next morning. If I say I felt terrible, I'm telling myself maybe I should quit. Maybe I shouldn't do this. I kicked myself. I said, because of me, my kid got cut twice. And, and everyone was talking, you know, and weren't talking too quietly either. So the kid's okay, right? You know, nothing happened, but... You know, I didn't cut enough, so he takes it and he cuts a second time, and whatever, okay. I didn't learn by him in the end, I learned by someone else, and Baruch Hashem, I did every other kid since then, and Baruch Hashem, fine. But I remember the feeling. I'm telling you, 2 cents would have been overpriced, how low I felt. I felt like, how could I face the world at this? Everyone's looking at me and talking, and they were talking, you know. What kind of bum does that to his own kid? Well, okay, fine. Ask yourself. Every person has those moments when they really feel like a total failure, and you could start telling him you did A and B and C. You're not so bad, right? But then you don't feel like you're not so bad. You feel like, hey, no, this really outweighs everything else. If everything else was so good, then how did I do this? Now, in hindsight, so I could tell you what I said in the beginning. The teacher wasn't a good teacher. He didn't do it right, and he didn't prepare me right. And whose fault was it? It was his. And what kind of bum tells his student in front of everyone, you know, not like that. You have to fix it. But what are you going and embarrassing me in front of everyone? That's all true. But that doesn't matter. That's in hindsight. A decade passed since then. I could look back and say, okay, I didn't do something that was wrong. But that doesn't matter. That's not what I felt then. Then I didn't know anything, you know. The teacher tells you you're a bad student. You say, okay, I hurt my own kid. You feel terrible. You don't realize, hey, he's a bad teacher. That's not right. You don't realize that at the time. Today, okay, a decade passed. I could look back and say, okay, I can live with myself. But that doesn't matter. At the time, I'm telling you, I remember walking out to shul and feeling like, I wish I could put the towels over my head coming out of the house. Okay. We have those times in life where we look at our failure and we say, oh boy, I knew I was a failure. I didn't know I was that bad. You know, I didn't know everyone had to see I was so bad. You know, I thought I could keep it covered for life. There are those moments where, like someone told me, sometimes you're in yeshiva and you feel like, this is such a fake. When are they going to say cut? You know, finish playing this role. Yeah, we all have that facade, that veneer which we put forward, and we're scared one day everyone's going to see who I really am. We want in a relationship to feel like they see who I really am and they accept me, but they want it too. And if we want it, we have to be able to give it. And to give it means to be able to accept the person as is. She's not perfect. She knows it. But she wants you to love her as is. And we'll end with the story. There was a woman who was going to class on self-improvement. So the teacher of the class gave them an assignment. Every one of you should go home. Tell your husbands to make a list of what you should improve on, so you have what to work on. So the next week, they all get together. And every woman walks in with this look. If looks can kill, their looks could kill. None of the women were happy but one. So they go around the classroom and each one tells how their husband prepared them a list. And things haven't been too pretty since. Except one woman. Her husband said, you know what, honey, I got to make a list of 10 things. I'll get back to you tomorrow. Let me think about it, okay? So the next day, the doorbell rings, and there's a bouquet of 10 roses. And each rose has a little sign hanging on it that says, I love you the way you are. So her husband said, that's my list. We all know our faults. Sometimes we know them better, sometimes we know them worse. Sometimes we deny them, sometimes we exaggerate them. At the end of the day, we work, sometimes we accomplish more, sometimes we accomplish less. What we want in a relationship is someone who will accept us as is. And that's our responsibility too. Oh, we'll build, we'll grow in a relationship. And we will grow naturally. But we have to be willing to accept and work together. Working together positively, with compliments, with warmth. And from there, we can grow. You remember I told you the ad about looking for a friend, I won't do much. I'll sleep lazily in your lap. I'll always be happy to see you. Remember? 10,000 responses. It was a dog. Right? Okay. So that's what we all want. We don't need that much from the relationship. You'd be surprised. What we really need is acceptance. And that's what our spouses need too. Everything else is negotiable. If you can give that, that's one of the major steps to a beautiful relationship.